Argument 3. Infant baptizers claim that the church is the same in both testaments. This is the third way in which infant baptizers try to support their practice, and it's closely allied to their flawed view of the covenant, arising out of their mistake over the continuity-discontinuity of the testaments. Contending that the church is the same in both testaments, they consequently argue that what circumcision was in the Old Testament, baptism is in the New. Baptism, they say, has replaced circumcision. That being so, they go on to argue that since infants were circumcised in the Old Testament church, as they put it, infants ought to be baptized in the New Testament church. John P. Sartell actually opened his booklet, What Christian Parents Should Know About Infant Baptism, by saying, "We begin our study with the Old Testament character Abraham." What a remarkable opening statement in a booklet to deal with baptism, a New Testament ordinance. Would infant baptizers begin a study on the Lord's Supper with the Passover? Would they set about an examination of church discipline by looking at Moses and the man gathering sticks? Do we embark on a discussion of the duties of church elders by considering the hierarchical appointment of the 70 judges to help Moses? Is it not a golden rule of biblical interpretation to start with passages which deal most fully, explicitly, with the subject in hand? Surely the practice of a New Testament ordinance began in the New Testament, did it not? This would seem self-evident. Shouldn't, therefore, the New, not the Old Testament, set the parameters for its practice? And shouldn't the study and explanation of such an ordinance begin, to say the least, in the New Testament? What did Abraham know about baptism? Of course, Sartell started with Abraham, because he thought that Abraham was in the church, and baptism is the equivalent of circumcision. But that was begging the question. Warfield wrote of the continuity of the Church of God in the Scriptures, and of the inclusion of children in the church in its pre-Christian form. Thus, he argued, the Old Testament practice of circumcision is the basis of the New Testament ordinance of baptism. He even went as far as to assert, if the continuity of the church through all ages can be made good, the warrant for infant baptism is not to be sought in the New Testament, but in the Old Testament. This is another remarkable statement, being nothing less than an admission of the non-New Testament basis for the practice of infant baptism. And since its premise, the continuity of the church in all ages, is false, then it follows that there is no warrant whatsoever for the practice of infant baptism according to Warfield's own words. Yet he was even prepared to say that this sense of continuity was so strong and so obvious in the apostolic age, he did not doubt that the children born into the church during this age were both circumcised and baptized. Indeed, the change from circumcision to baptism, he alleged, was slow, and never came until it was forced by the actual pressure of circumstances. The instrument for making this change was Paul. We see the change formally constituted in Acts 15. This is an amazing rewriting of the Acts, is it not? Baptism is not even mentioned in Acts 15. Warfield must have had extraordinary powers of sight if in that chapter he could see infant baptism replacing circumcision as its equivalent. Dabney wrote that the church is substantially the same under both dispensations, retaining under the new the same membership and nature, though with a subtle change of circumstances, which it had under the old. Did Dabney really think that the Israelites of the Old Testament and the saints of the New were members of the same church, and in the same way, allowing for suitable differences of circumstances. A.A. Hodge went even further than Dabney. He boldly stated that the church under the old dispensation is precisely the same church with the Christian church under the new. Precisely the same. The entire scheme is based upon a faulty foundation. Actually, it has no foundation at all. The church in the Old Testament is not the same as the church in the New Testament, for the simple reason the church did not even exist in the Old Testament. It is entirely a New Testament body. Hence the deductions of infant baptizers are based on a false premise. In particular, it is useless to argue from this false premise to say that baptism has replaced circumcision. It has done nothing of the kind. Pierre Marcel's words may be regarded as typical of the infant baptizer's view. He claimed that the church has been and remains one. The nation of Israel was the church. The Christian church, since it also comes under the covenant of grace, is the same church. Take careful note of Marcel's words. He said that the nation of Israel was the church. This is a staggering statement. It will take some justification. It cannot be done. It is utterly false. The nation of Israel was not the church. Though infant baptizers frequently refer to the Jewish church, there was no such thing. When they qualify the church and call it the Christian church or a gospel church and so on, they merely add to this confusion. R. A. Cole, for example, wrote that after Christ's breach with the church of Jewry, the Lord began to constitute his own church. His own church? As opposed to somebody else's church? The Christian church? Is there any other? We ought to do as the New Testament does and speak only of the church of Christ. Burkhoff, writing on the Sinaitic covenant, said, in a large measure, church and state became one. To be in the church was to be in the nation, and vice versa, and to leave the church was to leave the nation. What a manifestly false assertion! The nation of Israel, the church. Matthew Henry, commenting on Mark 2:23, where it is recorded that the disciples ate the corn on the Sabbath, said, what a poor breakfast Christ's disciples had on a Sabbath day morning when they were going to church. Going to church? They must have had a remarkably long journey that Sabbath. The church was not even founded at the time. And what a mongrel mix-up, the Sabbath and the church. Nevertheless, there's the claim. The church is the same in both testaments, infant baptizers say. Sadly, some Baptists agree with them. Errol Hulse, for instance, who said, the gospel church is not a different church from that which existed in the Old Testament period. If so, an interesting question arises. According to infant baptizers, the disciples were members of the church before they met Christ. After all, they were in the covenant, they were circumcised, they belonged to the nation of Israel, hence they were members of the church, according to infant baptizers. Presumably, on regeneration, they became members again. But the point is this, if they were members of the church before they met Christ, why did Christ say he had chosen them out of the world? John 15:19. According to infant baptizers, he had chosen them out of the church. Furthermore, if Jews had been properly admitted to the church by circumcision, why did they have to be admitted to the church all over again by baptism? Why were Jewish converts baptized? Indeed, why, if circumcised, are they today? At first glance, the Authorized or King James version of Acts 7:38 appears to justify the idea that the nation of Israel was the church, and therefore supports the claim that the church existed in the Old Testament. The verse speaks of the church in the wilderness. This, however, is a misleading translation of Stephen's words. Instead of church, ecclesia should here be translated congregation or assembly. The Greek word means a gathering of citizens called out to a public place, a gathering or throng. In the Greek version of the Old Testament, the Septuagint, the word is used for the assembly, throng, or gathering of the Israelites, and that is how Stephen used it. Unfortunately, the Authorized or King James version, for reasons of its own, translated it badly by the word church, which in the New Testament takes on an altogether different meaning, being used in a technical, specialized sense peculiar to itself. In these New Testament terms, it now means a church, a covenanted body of baptized saints gathered in the name of Christ for the worship of God and so on. But Stephen did not intend to convey that meaning. He used the word in its Greek, Septuagint, or Old Testament sense, meaning the throng or assembly of Israel. The Greeks themselves also used exactly the same word to speak of an assembly of citizens convened in a public place to deliberate some particular issue. That is the way the very word translated church in Acts 7:38 is used in Acts 19:39. Nobody would dream of translating Acts 19:39, the lawful assembly, a legally gathered assembly of citizens or court, as the lawful church. Stephen's words, badly mistranslated in the Authorized or King James version, do not in any way support the claim that the church existed in the Old Testament. It has nothing to do with it. The church, the word used in the spiritual New Testament or Christian sense, is, as I say, entirely a New Testament body. How could it exist in the Old Testament? The very first time it appears in the Bible is in Matthew 16:18, where Jesus said, "I will build my church." Exactly so. That was the founding of the church, and it took practical effect on the day of Pentecost. We know that the church is built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone. In this verse, we have the foundation of the church. What or who is the foundation? The apostles and prophets. There is no question or debate over who the apostles were, but who were the prophets? Did Paul mean the Old Testament prophets, or did he mean the New Testament prophets? Clearly, he meant the prophets of the New Testament. Why? For three reasons. First, if he had intended the Old Testament prophets, he would not have said the apostles and prophets, but he would have said the prophets and apostles, putting them in their proper chronological order. Secondly, the immediate context in which Paul wrote makes it abundantly plain that he meant New Testament prophets. A few verses later, he spoke of the mystery of Christ, which in other ages was not made known to the sons of men, as it has now been revealed by the Spirit to his holy apostles and prophets. Clearly, the prophets in this verse were the New Testament prophets. The mystery had been fully revealed to them now. This makes it very likely, to put it no stronger, that those spoken of in the earlier passage were those same New Testament prophets. Again, shortly after, when speaking of the church and the gifts Christ gave to the church after his ascension, Paul said that he himself gave some to be apostles, some prophets. This refers without doubt to the New Testament prophets. Thus, the context gives a second reason, which makes it extremely likely, to say the least, that Ephesians 2:20 relates to the New Testament prophets. See also 1 Corinthians 12, verse 28. Thirdly, Paul did not write of the apostles and the prophets, but the apostles and prophets. The one definite article qualifies both apostles and prophets. They were together, the one foundation of the church. They were the joint instrument through which God revealed his truth to found the church, with Christ the chief cornerstone. The apostles were New Testament men. Likewise, these prophets. For these three reasons we may say, without question, Ephesians 2:20 teaches that the church was founded in the New Testament. And since it was founded in the New Testament, how could it exist in the Old? It did not, it could not, exist before it was founded. Hence, for infant baptizers to maintain that the church is the same in both testaments must be completely wrong. It did not even exist in the Old Testament. And consequently, any and every practice which is deduced on that false basis must itself be false. In particular, infant baptism cannot be justified by this argument of the so-called continuity of the church. Of course, there were true believers in the Old Testament, and they were saved in the same way as believers in the New Testament. They were in the same covenant as New Testament saints, and they will inherit the same eternal glory. In the previous chapter, I spoke of the spiritual aspect of the Abrahamic covenant. This is part of it. The believers of both testaments are in the same covenant with God, the New Covenant, which was the spiritual aspect of the Abrahamic covenant. But while all that was true of the saints of the Old Testament, it is entirely wrong to speak of the church in the Old Testament. There was no church at that time in the terms of the New Testament. Therefore, any attempt to apply Old Testament conditions to the church is greatly misguided. Sadly, the fallacious notion that the church existed in the Old Testament is one of the basic arguments of infant baptizers. As a result, they wrongly apply Old Testament practices and conditions, especially about circumcision, to the church. It leads to all sorts of trouble, and is baseless. When they talk about the Abrahamic church or the Mosaic church, they make utterly ridiculous statements. And when they talk of a gospel church, they simply add to the muddle. In particular, as a consequence of their mistaken view of the continuity of the church in both testaments, infant baptizers hold that New Testament baptism has replaced Old Testament circumcision. But since the church did not exist in the Old Testament, their appeal for the baptism of infants on that basis falls to the ground. Warfield summarized the total range of arguments employed by infant baptizers. The argument in a nutshell is simply this. God established his church in the days of Abraham and put children into it. They must remain there until he puts them out. He has nowhere put them out. They are still then members of his church and as such entitled to his ordinances. Among these ordinances is baptism. This is the argument in a nutshell, but the shell is empty. God established his church not in the days of Abraham, but through Christ in the New Testament. Israel was not the church. Furthermore, God never did put children into his church. God only ever put believers into his church, in the local sense of the word. The church is composed of the elect, not the elect and their children. Warfield's argument falls to the ground because it is based on a false premise. And since, as he said, his argument summarized the entire case of infant baptizers, it is the argument in a nutshell. Their whole hypothesis collapses.